All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Well, I suppose, like, what? Hopefully people will listen. Most people listen to Brummies anyway, so... slag them off live on air.
Laugh!
Except for Galatasaray, obviously.
Legend.
What legend?
Fair play to him.
Yeah.
All right, let's get started then. All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. Got loads of stuff to talk about this week. Loads of Olympic stuff.
Olympics, yeah. High energy this week. We're not suffering from the residue of COVID.
Yeah, hopefully we're back on the game.
I'm not going on the game, man.
Well, clearly not back on the game, anyway. Also we've got some footy transfer stuff to talk about, just because like they've got the new season starting, obviously, on Saturday, which has been mad. I think always when you have that international tournament, like in between seasons, it kind of feels like football never ends. I hate to feel what it's like actually being a footballer. Like, you know, when you have to do that sort of like, it'd be like the regular 9 month season. Then you got the preparation for an international tournament. Then you got the month of the international tournament. Then you probably get like 2 week holiday maybe in the full course of like 12 months.
I don't know why they do pre-season training, like matches against each other. Surely there's no need for it. Are they just scared of like...
I suppose if you've been off for like 3 months, because obviously, you know, probably 90% of the English Football League, like, they won't have like international tour.
So they'll probably have
like 2 or 3 months. Like, obviously, it's only the elite players, I think, that are going to play at the tournaments, but...
like Slabhead and the boys.
But some of them start well early, like Celtic are already, I think they're already out of the Champions League or something.
They need all the practice they can get though, so...
And they got beat by like Midtjylland or something. But yeah, you get teams that like... They start their sort of season really, really early in July, and like, you know, it's a bit mad really.
I'm looking forward to like the season getting underway, because I want to see what Arsenal can do in the transfer market, although I'm not optimistic as you might imagine. So
yeah, we'll have a chat about that as well a bit later. All right, so we'll go through the five things you might have missed. Number one, Hong Kong police have arrested a man after he allegedly booed the Chinese national anthem while watching an Olympics award ceremony inside a shopping mall. He was arrested on suspicion of breaking the national anthem ordinance, which came into effect in June last year, which surprised me because I thought the Chinese would have that unlock, like from yeah, day one. Like, if you're booing the national anthem, you get thrown into a gulag for 3 years. But the charge carries a maximum penalty of 3 years imprisonment.
Fair enough, isn't it, really?
But like this 40-year-old, he was accused of insulting, because I imagine they would find it quite insulting, the March of the Volunteers, which is the China National Anthem, which is an absolute barnstormer, by the way. Like, go and check it out. It's like, Chilai, 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 or something like that. I think it's just like, ride on in glory, defeat our enemies,
all that.
Like, yeah, it's super intense. Obviously, it was played during fencer Edgar Chung's first gold medal win for Hong Kong in 25 years. So just picture the scene. They're in a shopping mall in Hong Kong. There's thousands of people there watching on the big screen. Edward Chung just about to get his gold medal. They play the national anthem. There's just one geezer like, boo!
Is that Homer Simpson? Yeah. That is hilarious.
Or the police just like pop up out of like you know, yeah, just through the bushes. Through the bushes.
The sewers and yeah. But you know, have they got a dodgy designation? Like, Taiwan's, they're Chinese Taipei. To Hong Kong, are they called something else?
But yeah, I think there's a big, like, especially with the Taiwanese, like, if you ask anyone from Taiwan, are you Chinese? They're like, nah,
no.
I'm Taiwanese. And yeah. I think it's similar with Hong Kong. Yeah. Like, they want to be completely detached from China, but I mean, even though kind of they are yeah, Chinese traditionally, because obviously it was only because of the invasion.
Yeah.
Like, in like 1903.
But in terms of their flag, like, do they have like a next flag or?
Yeah, yeah, they're under their own banner. They've got their own flag, got their own government and all that shit. But
yeah, Homer Simpson killing it, man, in the Hong Kong shopping mall.
But let's keep a prayer in our thoughts for this guy, and hopefully he doesn't get too long in prison.
He's definitely going to get the full whack in it, man. 3 years.
The full force of the law. Yeah. Right, number two, a sports commentator in Greece who made an on-air remark about a South Korean athlete at the Tokyo Olympics has been fired. Yeah, asked directly about the skill of the South Korean table tennis player by a fellow commentator, Demosthenis Kamirius said, "Their eyes are narrow, so I can't understand how they can see the ball moving back and forth." The sort of joke that your racist old uncle makes at family parties, isn't it?
I am not laughing at that joke. That is insulting and racist. I do not like that joke at all.
Absolute shocker.
Can you say it on
live on air, like? It's not even like casual racist humour, is it? It's just pure racist. Like
that's a. It must be so natural to him. The thought must have just jumped into his head to be like, "Don't know how you see through them."
Yes. Yes. So fucked up. But yeah. Obviously, this geezer's been moved on fairly swiftly.
Maybe his wife left him for a career, man. You never know.
Yeah, there's obviously some resentment built up there, isn't there? All right, so number three, Derby midfielder Jason Knight's going to miss up to 12 weeks, unfortunately, after getting injured in training. To add to Derby's growing list of worries going into the start of the Championship season this weekend. Who was the person who tackled him training, you ask? None other than his manager, Wayne Rooney. Big Wayne.
I've read about this, mate. It's so jokes that he's still flying in tackles in training, man. He's like, how old is he now? Like 40 or something?
No, I think he's only like 35, but he looks 50. 35 going on 50, like. But apparently Derby have got so few first team players that obviously he's having to fill in training sessions. But he's having a rough few weeks, isn't he? Rooney after he had the controversy with like being steaming and in a hotel room with a couple of birds.
Yeah,
like.
Apparently those birds were calling him Wayne Clooney.
Clooney.
They didn't know who he was, innit? But like the only reason he's still in the job is because he's apologised to his missus and his family and the club. And they're like, yeah, he can stand. But I don't suppose they'd be able to replace him anyway if they're struggling to fill the first team, so
I suppose like they're in the realms of hypocrisy, really, Derby, because a few years ago they had Richard Keogh. He was on a night out with like a couple of lads, Mason Bennett, can't remember who the other one was, but they were drunk driving in it, and Richard Keogh was the club captain. And he was in the back, and he ended up like seriously damaging his knee or something, and they sacked him because of it. Because he was the club captain and it was seen that he was like, you know, meant to be setting a an example for the players and stuff like that. And they would drink driving. They fucked him off.
Yeah, but
Big Wayne, man? Big Wayne's getting away with it.
Waz is a legend, man. He gets a few more chances. He's like England all-time top scorer, isn't he? Come on,
Go on, Shrek. All right, and number four. So apparently Twitter says in France, there is a majestic 15-year-old stallion, that's a horse, by the way, just in case you didn't know, named Peo, who often comes to comfort and soothe terminal patients at the Tesha Hospital in Calais. So the horse chooses which patient he wants to see, and he sort of like kicks his hooves outside the door. Is this beautiful or terrifying?
Well, I went for a country walk last Saturday and unexpectedly chanced upon a couple of fillies. Yeah. And I'm not like used to animals that size. They were massive, so it scared the shit out of me. But like children a little bit, let the missus and the dog go around the fence, distracting them. They were just really calm and timid, man. I suppose.
And imagine a couple of young fillies compared to this big old stallion kicking his hooves outside your door when you're on your deathbed.
They seem quite caring horses, so maybe you just need to chill them for a bit, like elephants, innit? If you described an elephant to someone, you'd be like, get that fucking thing away from me. But if you chilled with one for a little bit, you'd be like, oh, they're kind of cool. So,
So we think this is probably on the more than beautiful
right,
side.
Yeah,
not too bad.
Still quite scary, like.
Yeah.
Have you tripping balls on morphine as well?
Yeah, that's not going to add to the experience, is it? Right, good number five then.
Yeah, so Canadian pole vaulter Alicia Newman is diversifying her portfolio by opening an OnlyFans account and charging subscribers $19.99 a month for her exclusive content. She announced the move on Instagram with the caption, "Your wish is my command." OnlyFans is known for highly sexualized content and controversies regarding underage content suppliers, money laundering, and a whole heap of other discrepancies. So Alicia wants the bag. She wants all the dough, and she's well able for an OnlyFans account.
I'd say. This is like halfway between like YouPorn and like YouTube. It's kind of like a subscription based. All right, you give me $20 a month and she can get as many subscribers as she wants, and then she posts a few raunchy photos or whatever. I don't know how raunchy it gets, because obviously
I did a quick Google search because I'm not on OnlyFans or anything like that, and it's saying like the competition's so fierce that they compete with each other for content, and because it's so sexual and that, things get out of hand pretty quick, man. So like
I think there's been women that are not even, they haven't got sort of like any sort of fame going into it. They can make like 50 bags a month, easily from like this, like really sort of like, it is highly sexualized, but like you ain't going to go on there and it's not going to be like Instagram photos, is it? It's going to be like a bit naughty, a bit raunchy.
I think it probably will be a bit more like that, because what else are you paying £20 a month for?
You know, fair fucks, man. She's opened up a new avenue stream. I ain't me funny, but if I was a bird and I was fit, I would do it. I would be on there straight away. I'd be showing the lot, man.
Discount Thursdays.
You know what I mean? I'll be doing like $2 a month, man. $20. Like, you know, I think because she's already famous and obviously she's already built up, like, I think it was like 750,000 followers on Instagram.
Yeah, all, mate, all gets, men of culture.
She gets men of, like, you know what I mean? Young boys. But like, 10% of those, and he probably ain't, man. He's probably like 50-year-old blokes. Ain't they? They got bags. Like they probably just like they've yeah. probably got like 10 subscriptions to like yeah, different yeah,
yeah.
birds and that.
Going the whole time, trying to get that marriage proposal in. Yeah,
what a brilliant idea as well.
It's good because we always talk about how athletes struggle for post-athletic careers, isn't it? So yeah. she's opening one up for us, at least till she's about 35.
Yeah, I think we are getting into that realm where this is considered like a viable sort of like a viable option, like even for like 18-year-olds, it sounds a bit seedy, really, but
yeah, it is
like,
proper seedy, but it is a genuine. But girls way to do make it. Money.
Yeah, it's a genuine way to make money, and you know, I think there's a lot of girls and women that are like at university and they want to make extra funds because like the old school one was like you know strippers that you'd see in the nightclubs and that.
It's a way to make a lot of money for very little effort, and that's the dream, isn't it?
So. Isn't it? Absolutely. So fair play to them. All right, so let's move into that. That'll be the end of the five things you might have missed. We'll move into the general sports stuff, and this is just kind of like a load of tidbits because there's been so much has happened in the last sort of like week in the Olympics. There's no way we could cover it all, so we're just going to basically go through a few of the sort of like highlights over
see
the last few days.
See what pops up as we talk.
And just chat shit about it. You can criticise whoever you want.
Oh yeah, well,
I might be more on the critical side like this week. Though,
we'll see how it goes.
We'll start off with the 10,000 meter men's final manners because like I know we were both sort of watching this at the same time, and you know obviously we're not shocked. I'm definitely not shocked at the dominance of the Kenyans, Ethiopians, Ugandans. Like how good have they been in this event for such a long time? You know, sort of long distance running. Barega of Ethiopia wins gold, with silver and bronze going to two Ugandan runners. So like. You were watching this and you were just mesmerized by the tactics that some of these runners were employing. So what did you notice about it?
At the beginning, they were saying that Cheptegei was the favorite for Uganda. So I was thinking, okay, I'll just watch that guy, the British guy, and then a few other people. But as soon as the first lap started, another Ugandan called Kisa, he was like nearly a full lap.
I
was thinking, what's going on here? And as the race developed, they were saying that like he's trying to lure people out of the pack behind so that Cheptegei can pace himself according to them and then blast at the end.
Which is exactly what happens in horse racing, man.
There's
a huge comparison. Like, all the old school, like, Frankel was the big one over a mile. Like, he was like the most fantastic horse that anyone's ever seen, in my opinion. Never lost, 14 wins. He was beating like Group 1 horses that were like on another level, and he was just like, He was just using them as like almost like a step into, like he was just gliding past them, like. But he'd always have someone from his stable that would go. Not always actually, but like some of the horses, the bigger horses, they'd have like what do they call it? Like a front runner. I think it's like a front runner, and a horse would sort of like set the pace, and it's the same thing to disrupt the rhythm of the other horses.
What got me was as soon as it became obvious that none of the other runners were biting. Kisa just stopped running. And I was thinking, that is so deep that you're going to be this guy's running partner week in, week out throughout the season, the various competitions, and your job is to make sure he gets gold. I was thinking, that is a mad, selfless position to be in.
And it shows you how far ahead they are of the competition in terms of like that they can have a strategy like that. You know, we're lucky, or most countries are happy if they can get one bloke in the final. That's got a chance.
They have three people in the final.
Exactly. And so they know that they need to sort of like diversify their tactics, like to try and make sure that they have a bloke that comes out at the end with a gold.
But it went awry because what was his name for Ethiopia? Barega? Seliman Barega. He anticipated what was coming and he put the burners on before Cheptegei did. And Cheptegei was like 2 or 3 seconds behind him. Then he decided to go with him.
Yeah, but he couldn't catch him.
He couldn't keep pace with him. And I thought, that is crazy. So not only...
And it's mad that their last lap is like the fastest. It's like they've just done 8,000 whatever, 8,500 meters. And then that last 1,000 meters, they can step it up.
It's like it's a next level of endurance. And like they were talking about the Ethiopian team and their training philosophy, and they were saying they're really practicing their running speed, and I thought, well, obviously this is 10,000 meters, but they were saying it's the type of running where you integrate like 80% run back down to 50, 80% run back down to 50, and then keep between 50 and 100%, but keep going up and down through those speeds just to get your motor running. And it's kind of like a high level interval training at the top of your BPMs or whatever it is. And I was thinking like, that is crazy, man. So impressive.
Yeah. And it's amazing the different running styles that they have to have. Like obviously going from sort of like 400 meters, which is a very, very short sort of time, isn't it? Like 40 seconds or whatever. And then you've got like the marathon running. Like completely contrasting styles in how they need to train and how they need to like sort of set up their strategy when it comes to like these races.
Yeah, definitely. Because you see like the Jamaicans, they absolutely don't off the short distances.
Yeah.
But once you get to like 400 meters, they're not that prominent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of mad. Like it's completely different types of running.
As I say, we're going to mention a guy called David Epstein, and he's The Sports Gene, which is a book that I need to give to you, or I can't even remember. But like,
I think you might have given it to me.
Yeah, yeah. You need to read it, man.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, just going into sort of like, you know, this sort of nature versus nurture sort of like debate, just only slightly, and you know, the sort of genetics, you know, this dominance of East Africa when it comes to long distance running, and then you've got this sort of the West African sort of like, I think the, you know, the period of slavery and stuff like that, and how, you know, how these slaves got to Jamaica, and you know, how the, you know, Jamaica dominating this, there's like a small village in Jamaica that like all these runners are from, all these short distance runners, like Usain Bolt, I think like...
Johan Blake and the Bolt.
Johan Blake, I think he was from a similar village, and there was another female, not the one that just won the two goals.
Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, maybe.
Yeah, it might be Fraser-Pryce. And then obviously you've got that Thompson Herat.
She's the one that just won gold.
It's just incredible, man. And I think it's so interesting to see like where, you know, genetically, where these people have come from, and the fact that they're dominating over such a, you know, over such a long distance, absolute dominance, isn't it? Like pure dominance.
That Michael Costello, who's the new DAZN boxing commentator, and he does a boxing podcast with Steve Bunce.
Yeah.
He covers athletics a lot as well, and he's saying he went to, I think it was Somalia or Ethiopia, and he like a prominent training camp, and he said like the kids, that they're running groups for long, long distances, and it's like they look like they're going top speed. Running is just a thing that they do anyway. And then they're genetically gifted and they're fine-tuned their training to a point where they're like masters at the distance.
So it's a combination of having the genetics and then the nurture part being sort of, all right, it's, you know, it's a sport where you don't need to buy equipment. You just need a track.
Exactly.
So there's no kind of like monetary restrictions when it comes to sort of starting out. But then they've also got that culture and that heritage now. So that combines with the fact that you get like top schools in America that go to places in Africa, you know, very, very sort of like poor places, but they've got these like high level runners that are like 13 years old and they're already dining, like they could dine off like all the college kids back in America.
That's crazy, isn't it?
And then there's an opportunity there for them to offer scholarships and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy how the sport world works. But one of the theories that Epstein had, it's called the malaria effect. So they were saying like at times slaves were being taken to West Africa. Malaria was common. And it's got written down here that it seems two traits protected people against the disease. One was having the carrier of the sickle cell gene. Having two meant they had sickle cell anemia, but having one protected against malaria. And he thinks that this, one of the side effects was it was that they had low hemoglobin. And they're saying given iron supplements to this population increased malaria. All right. So these two traits tend to produce more fast twitch muscle fibers and prevent success in events that require endurance.
Oh my God.
So there's an actual genetic evidence that, you know, that they're dominant.
That is so interesting, man. I would never have put that together. And that explains the high cases of like sickle cell in like the Caribbean population.
But actually, it seems that that's been one of the sort of a driving forces in their success in sort of like short distance running. But, and another two interesting facts, there hasn't been a white cornerback in the NFL in more than a decade. And obviously that comes down to the fast twitch muscle fibers. Yeah. It's a position that's very explosive. You have to keep up with wide receivers and stuff like that. And the Jamaican record for the 10K would not have qualified for the 2012 Olympics.
What more evidence do you need?
You know what I mean? You think that running is a sport, you know, that you'd say, right, you know, the mechanics are pretty similar, but in terms of like how it's approached, it's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And when it comes to training and tactics. But yeah, that was pretty interesting. So we'll move on just because we spent a bit longer than that on that than I thought we were going to. But We'll move on to a shithouse alert. You probably saw this as well, didn't you? So the Belgium and Great Britain men's hockey teams indulged in the silky subtleties of shithousery. So like the last 5 minutes of their last group game prior to the quarterfinals was played at like a pedestrian pace. The game was tied at 2-2 and both teams knew that the result benefited them in it, because I think Great Britain would go on to play India, which unfortunately they lost. And then Belgium, who I think were one of the better teams in the world, they were going on to play like Argentina or Australia or something. But I think they've ended up getting to the final. But the last 5 minutes, literally, it was just the Belgian back three. They were just like knocking the ball like to each other.
That shouldn't be allowed, isn't it, really?
Yeah, isn't it? Because I think it happened in the... I think it was like the 1986 World Cup or something.
It was Austria and Germany.
Austria, Germany. In the last like 15 minutes, because they both knew that a draw would get them through... You know,
it's like, nah, we'll keep the ball. Or just a little tackling, put it out for a throw-in, just stall.
And that's what ended up, that's why they ended up moving to having the last group game on at the same time. So there's none of that sort of like going on. But
when the GB squad lost to India, I was thinking like, I didn't know Indians were sick at hockey, innit?
They're the most successful hockey team in the Olympics of all time.
The women's team were rinsing the Argentinians when I turned off the TV the other day. And I was thinking, that must be some like imperial relic. Like they're probably sick at croquet as well, man. Absolutely.
Well, look at cricket.
They're amazing
at cricket, innit? Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of like the sort of the disadvantages of imperialism. The only one, obviously. Now, it's all wrong. It's all nasty.
Yeah.
But you know, fair play to India though. Like you know, they've adopted these sports over the last like 130 years, probably longer than that.
They are killing it. Like to be fair, but I just it all clicked for me when I saw it. That it like I thought, how would they?
Same reason why the Australians are very good at rugby, and like you know, New Zealand and Fiji, and Fiji are just like they're on the. They're on the genetic side of the nature nurture thing, aren't they?
Mate, I saw a guy playing rugby for Fiji. He said he was 22. Bullshit. Muscles on his neck was like my thigh. He's 22, man. No way, man.
They were busting. They loved it as well, man. They were so passionate when they won that rugby sevens gold medal.
It's like the Swedish discus throwers. They were going, oh, here's the German, the oldest in the field, and he was 31. I was thinking, get out of town, man. These boys are like 50-year-old Odins, man, all of them.
But talking about very old competitors, we'll move on to Laurel Hubbard, who's 43, and obviously she became one of the first transgender athletes to compete in the Olympics, but she failed to post a score at all in the over 87 kilogram weightlifting event, and it was absolutely donned off by this 21-year-old Chinese girl.
Yeah, I saw her, man. I saw her.
She just stepped up to do, like, everybody was struggling with, like, trying to lift 130, 132. Like, on her first attempt, she just came up donned 162 and was like, all right, that's the gold. where's the Olympic record? What is it, 182? There you go, Don. So, like, she smashed it.
But the thing is, you need to, like, put your mind to how much 182 kilos actually is. Like, I'm 13.8 as of this morning. I'm about 86, 87 kilos. That's the whole body weight. Two of me plus like a dog or something. And then she's just like, oosh, clean, snap, bang.
Yeah, it.
I saw him do it. I thought, that is absolutely incredible.
And like, we're going to talk about I'm going to talk about sports that I don't think should be anywhere near the Olympics. This absolutely should be in the Olympics because like, there's so much like technique and training, that goes into like doing this and like the clean and jerk and stuff like that. Cause I didn't realize like the difference between them. Like, obviously, I think, is it the clean and jerk that's just straight up, not even the hold, or is that?
I think the clean and jerk is the one where you go straight up, yeah. That's the clean, that's the jerk.
Then because you can do it in a way that it just goes straight up, innit? Without sort of like the resting on the shoulders. Because I noticed that they don't always do it.
You know what, man?
There's two different records for it.
You know what? I'm thinking that I probably don't even know the exact differences between the clean and jerk and what?
It's a different technique.
And the press. The clean and press. The clean and jerk and the clean and press.
Something like that. But there is slightly different things. And like, I think they had different records because obviously, like, if you can rest it there and it give yourself
chill
a second.
Chill for a little bit.
And then you try and do the jerk, I guess. I was looking into it the other day. So I thought it was quite interesting because I didn't realize it was that deep.
I thought it was mad, like, because I saw the men's category. And the one guy who I think eventually won, the Uzbeki, he's like 21 years old, didn't even look that big.
Yeah.
He's like, no, but I was thinking.
All technique? It's got to be
all technique. Yeah. Well, not all technique, but.
Yeah, it's, obviously it's you need a lot of strength. And then it's about training, weight training in certain areas of the body that are important. Obviously, like, the thigh is very important. And it, like,
yeah, they say they don't do bench presses, it hurts your shoulder more,
but. Yeah, so there you go, matters. But yeah, the inclusion of obviously Laura Hubbard has been a massive controversy with the sort of IOC. You know, she was very vocal in sort of like the support that IOC gave her. She came closest to a successful lift on her second attempt. And she appeared to, you know, be credited for the 125 kilogram attempt, but the judges deemed it a no lift. So that was a bit of a shame. Obviously, she's retired since. She's come out and said, like, that's it. She's not going to compete again, which doesn't shock me because she's 43 years old. So she would be 46 going into the next Olympics.
Not really viable, is it?
No, because considering she was twice the age of most of the competitors there. But she was actually one of, I think, three transgender non-binary athletes to compete in this year's games. There's a Canadian football player known only as Quinn, just one name, looking like, so it's looking like they then will go on to receive at least a silver medal after Canada's shock defeat of the US women's national team, which I wanted to have a quick word on. So that will go down as somewhat of a, I would say, ignominious, like that sort of level for US women's soccer. And, you know, I think their head coach, Flatko Andonovsky, who I admit I'd never heard of, I think he's been quite successful in the women's game over there. But he's, you know, it's virtually inconceivable that, you know, that they've lost two games in the space of like a couple of weeks when they'd gone like, I think they'd gone like 44 games unbeaten or something, 2 years or
but
something.
But they're getting a bit older now, aren't they? That's what the commentators for BBC were saying. And that happens to all teams, man. It's the passing of the guard. Like the women's game internationally, it's got to have developed since the US began this period of dominance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is just a natural way of things. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, just going back to Laura Hubbard, I feel like there's been a lot of controversy about her, and also like going on to the, you know, the mental health side of it, which we're going to talk about as well today. Just because it's hard not to, really, because it's been such a sort of prominent a prominent focus of like this games, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's just the way it's emerged, and there's been a lot of like athletes that are like consistently coming out and sort of like and talking about mental health and it becoming a bit more of a topic. Obviously, we spoke a little bit about it last week and was on about Tyson Fury now. He kind of like, he almost started it, didn't he?
Yeah, man. He's the first guy to get the ball rolling because obviously he had his own struggles contemplating suicide. Gave his account of when he nearly committed suicide driving his car off a bridge.
Yeah.
And it's like, obviously, that is the most extreme side of it. And so he's trying to promote it and make it part of the conversation, but I'm a little bit conflicted with it. Do you know what I mean? But we'll get into it.
Yeah, I mean, just a few of the names that have come out in the last week, really. Obviously, Simone Biles was a big one, with her pulling out of her four of the five of her finals. She did end up doing the beam. Because apparently it was, because the routine or the, what do they call it? Yeah, the routine that she had sort of developed with her coaching staff prior to the tournament, it didn't have as many sort of like flips and she wasn't going to get the twisties. It's a term I've never heard before.
She came in second to the Chinese girl, didn't she?
I think third. I think there was two Chinese.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 16-year-old Chinese. She looked about 12
and she got
up there, done this amazing routine, and she could not believe like that she won gold at the end. It was so hilarious. Like 16 years old, she was like running around like, where am I meant to go? Like, you know, it was.
India said to me, she's like, oh, it's all downhill from here. It's like, I peaked at 16.
Hey, you know, you're peaking at 16. Like, Tyra Mings, Ben Stokes, Adam Peaty, there's another three, just like, as you know, they've drawn that growing list of athletes that have sort of directly stated a need to focus on matters of mental health, whether it be taking time away from competition, seeing psychiatrists, or whatever else they deem pertinent to combat the huge pressure that must weigh on these athletes who are not only extremely physically and financially healthy, but who can dictate their own social circles however they see fit. So I was getting a bit wound up about this. You know, they don't need to engage with the social media, like their social media accounts. A lot of them don't, do they anyway?
Yeah.
They have social media managers. But I wanted to get your sort of opinion on this because it's been winding me up for the last couple of weeks. It really has, because obviously there's a certain small percentage of like athletes that have serious demons.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we've spoke about mental health quite a lot before. Like, for example, me and you, like, you know, just average sort of like 30-year-old white blokes, ain't it? Nothing special about either of us.
Speak for yourself, mate. I'm killing it. Yeah.
But, it was me. Don't you be speaking for James like that. It's your
name. Yeah, go on, then.
But the whole point is, these athletes, right, there's absolutely, unless it's things that like are very, very, you know, tragic that happened in their lives. Like, you know, Simone Biles has come out and she said, oh, my aunt passed away as well during the Olympic thing.
That's something tough to deal with.
It sure. is, of course, it is a pass in the family. Like, it happens to anybody. It's always going to be tough to deal with. But obviously, we didn't know that from the media. And to be fair to Simone Biles, she I don't think she's milked any part of it, really.
Yeah, I don't either, to be honest. I had a problem with the way it was first handled by US gymnastics and the media than by her. I haven't seen her express any kind of self-pity or anything about it. She just kind of... to be fair, I didn't think she was going to come back for any event. So fair play to her for getting back on the beam.
Yeah, and obviously, it's been... In the media, it's been posturized. There's this kind of like what a brave soul she is, and getting that bronze was bigger than all of her goals. But at the end of the day, she's got the ability to be going through a rough patch with her technique and trying to deal with like her strategy around how she approaches it. And she's still good enough to get up there after all this adversity and still with a bronze. That shows you like how good she is in comparison to her competition. But coming out and saying, you know, this is better than our goals and stuff like that. Like, in my opinion, like, if you're good enough to do it, just get up there and do it, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't make a big song and dance about it. But we're probably talking, like, folks on her too much. But what about players like Tyrone Mings? Like, Tyrone Mings coming out and saying, like, he has to work, you know, he's going to have to, you know, he's been dealing with things over the Euros. Like, saying, oh, there's been, you know, there are a lot of struggles over this time. Come on, man.
Like, there's an element of this where, because it's such a relatable through line to every sport and competition and anything that's going on, because we're all human beings at the end of the day, and if every member of the audience can relate to this aspect of the athlete, then they're going to give it time. So Tyrone Mings, like, I don't know what kind of a person he is or what he's struggling through or what, say, if he's had a bereavement or if he's got actual mental health injuries, but there's an element of this where it's like airing your dirty laundry in public. Not everyone needs to know everything about you. I do think there's an element of like fishing for sympathy from people, or it's like the athletes themselves don't have to give these interviews, but at the same time, the TV companies push it as well to provide content for themselves. So it's not this compassionate thing. They're trying to get views up. Do you know what I mean? So they're kind of monetizing this supposedly empathetic mode that we're all in at the moment. It's a bit dodgy, man. Like, in general, it's better for everyone to feel comfortable expressing how they feel, but on the other hand, I feel like there's a lot of indulgence going on.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's tough, the fact that these media companies are using the social media like conversation as a money making tool, really.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, so they're using the idea of it, and who better for people to read about, then they're sort of like, you know, their heroes, like their sporting heroes, and a lot of big prominent figures, like even like, you know, Ben Stokes and obviously Adam Peaty. He's saying he might step away for, like, you know, he's just won gold.
For him, it's pretty much job done, isn't it?
Like, yeah, and he's just unbelievable, like, you know what I mean? So we spoke about him last week and like how dominant he's been in his sport. But, you know, I just think you're happiest, like, you know, when you're healthy, you're physically healthy, they've got financial health, and for these athletes to constantly come out and, you know, keep on sort of like, you know, banging on this drum about like having to focus on mental health, like that is probably the only thing they have to, the only thing that they need to focus on, because they got everything else.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's a bit tone deaf, really, because the people that pay the money to come and watch these athletes, right, 30, 40 quid to them, and like, we spoke about the Blues tickets, like 40 quid on Saturday, which is, you know, quite a lot of money, especially in the pandemic, and like,
especially people, to watch Blues as well.
Yeah, and to watch Blues. But I'm just using an example. But who you know, whatever fans, because like the sport is nothing without fans, and like the Olympics haven't been the same without people in, you know.
Yeah, it's been a bit dead, hasn't it,
in the arenas. But 30, 40 quid for the working class man or woman is a lot of money.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? So, like, my point is the fact that like that we're struggling just to scrimp up money to go and watch the athletes. But these athletes themselves are coming out and saying, you know, oh, well, my mental health and this and that. All right. Yeah, but fair enough. What about all the struggles that people have to deal with every day? Like, real pressure? Like, real pressure of like a woman who's a single mom, got three kids, she's got three jobs, trying to, you know, to manage all this. And that's real fucking pressure, isn't it?
And that, like, she has to watch Dina Asher-Smith cry her eyes out because she's got a hamstring pull. Like, do you know what I mean? It's a little bit distasteful. I know what you mean, man. I didn't really think about that before.
It starts to run me over the wrong way a bit because, like, I think about all the people that have struggled, like, over this pandemic period especially. And then you've got these athletes that can't, you know, all right, if we get it. You spend 4 years of your life, you know, working for this moment. And if it doesn't quite go right for you, whether, you know, you're not good enough or there's an injury and something, but I'm not going to sit there and sort of empathize with you too much.
There are people who, no matter what their material situation. Okay, when we were talking about this before, it jumped to mind. Remember Chester Bennington from Linkin Park?
Yeah.
And there's another guy, Anthony Bourdain, who's like a celebrity chef, TV presenter, author type guy. And they both committed suicide a few years ago.
Mm.
Now, these are guys that are beloved by their fans, respected by their peers,
mm-hmm.
for all intents and purposes, have, aside from the personal grievances and griefs and tragedies that we all suffer, they seem to be in as good a position as you can hope to be in as a human being. And they still couldn't deal with reality. Now, obviously, that's the extreme end of the spectrum. And I'd say most people aren't anywhere near that. Like, true suicidal thoughts constantly, that has got to be just a living torture. We spoke before about winning the lottery of life, being born where we are to the parents that we've been born to, in the country that we've been, in the time that we've been born to.
Yeah.
And that is like losing a massive roll of the dice genetically to have those thoughts in your head. So I've got every sympathy in the world for people on that scale. But I do not equate athletic disappointment with
suicidal thoughts.
Just don't. It's not the same thing.
And that kind of, it does seem that that's the avenue some of these athletes are going down, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like you say, it's kind of like a poor me. Poor me. Like, Dina Asher-Smith interview the other day, I spoke to you and I spoke to India about it, and you and India had a similar response to it, whereas like, this is like a heartbreaking thing. Obviously the injury she's gone through, the pain and suffering.
Yeah.
I thought it was really self-indulgent, man.
Yeah, a little
really,
bit.
Really? I thought she was like...
Did you watch the 40-second clip or the 2-minute clip?
I watched the 2-minute clip about 5 times.
Yeah, and I watched the 40-second one and I didn't get an emotional attachment on it. And I watched the 2-minute one and I think they had a little bit more context there. And I think, I get what you're saying. And I think years ago, we probably would have had a bit more emotional attachment to that. But now it does feel like every British athletic or, you know, somebody that's failed, they're now crying on TV. And it's just like, the media companies are just like,
let's bring a bit more of this out. But you know, before the race, she was in a studio, and bear in mind, I don't know when this interview's happened, pre-injury, post-injury. She's saying, and I love the way she was talking before the race. She was going, look, I know that someone could run a world record tomorrow. And I said, I don't worry about that because they have to worry about me. And I thought, woo, that's a Michael Jordan talk right there. She sounds like a winner. And then she came in third, ended up not qualifying. And then I just thought, okay, that just didn't go how she planned. She didn't have a good race. 100 meters is not a long time. There's loads of different things that could go wrong that can shave tenths and hundreds of seconds off your time. So then I was thinking, okay, she just got blasted out of there. And then afterwards, for her to come down and be like, I just want to speak to you and just say about my life in the past couple of years and my athletic journey and da, da, da. And then she starts crying. It's like, mate, don't give it a big talk. Don't give it to Conor McGregor.
And then the injuries came out as well. Like, nobody's even spoke about having injuries.
And she was, like, fair play to her. She got back on the horse in the 4x100 meters relay today. So I was thinking, obviously, you're all right to do that leg. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So don't give it to Conor McGregor beforehand and afterwards be like, oh, I came in with injury.
You just got to stick to your guns.
You have to quiet, man. Take it like a champ. Maybe I'm asking a bit much because the frustration levels must have been out of this world. But still, man, like, take it on the chin. Do you know what I mean?
I just feel like we're generally becoming desensitized to like the athletes.
Yeah, I'm becoming apathetic towards it, man. And that's the exact opposite response that I want to have. I want to be more compassionate. I want to have more empathy. But when I hear it so much, I just think, Jesus Christ.
It's just too much. Just stop banging that drum. But we were talking about like being a basically a buzz term, like definitely protecting your mental health. It has become a bit more of a buzz term now, isn't it? But we'll sort of move on. We'll talk a little bit about GB gold. So Bethany Schriever, she wins gold for GB in the BMXing. The BMXing and the skateboarding, I think, has been wicked, man. She had to crowdfund her way to get to Tokyo Olympics because basically there was no funding.
That's cool,
in BMXing. And then the male rider, Kai White, he also won silver. As we keep on sort of managing to get medals in sports that we had no idea that we had any athletes in.
No clue. I didn't even realise. Actually, I think I knew BMXing was part of the Olympics, but I didn't realise there was any kind of prominence. I would think like the Americans would be smashing that up.
Yeah, and I think that was in the sort of like going around the sort of like hilly track. It's got, I guess, like a relay.
I don't know why any of it's going.
But then, you know, we had another success in the BMX freestyling, which was like riveting, man. They were doing like the mad tricks, like the handlebar tricks.
Oh, yeah, I missed all that, you know.
And fucking this Hannah Roberts, right? She did like this. Oh, no, Hannah Roberts is the American. So, you know, she's a 19-year-old and apparently she's been sort of BMXing since she was like 8 and she's like the world champion. She thought she'd done enough. She posted like a score of like 96 odd. And then this Charlotte Worthington from Manchester, like a proper like local girl, she was working, like she was saying she was working in a takeaway, like, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. Her first attempt, she fucked up this trick that had never been done by a female.
It's like
ever.
A double backflip.
Something like that. I think 360 backflip. Yeah. But she got up and she absolutely smashed her second attempt. The commentators were absolutely buzzing. Yeah, it was a 360 backflip. The first time it had ever been attempted in competition, and she nailed it. Honestly, for anybody that hasn't seen that, go and watch it. I know there's loads of videos like around there at the moment. Everyone's like, you know, I've set new records and stuff. But this was really, really impressive. And then sticking with the world of extreme sports, I think it was a couple of days ago. Another crazily young podium.
Yeah.
I think that all teenagers again, same as it was in the first skateboarding event. But Britain's own, Skye Brown, she's like half living in Japan, half living in the US.
Yeah.
Her dad's like, her mum's Japanese, her dad hasn't lived in Britain since he was like 10 or something.
We're claiming her, who cares, man?
But, yeah, GB's claimed her, like, you know, she's got an American accent as well. But she's gonna be British, isn't she?
We've got an American woman. I don't know if she's still competing.
American woman.
American, stay away from me. And then we've got a Jamaican lad in the relay team. Like, we're claiming everyone. We welcome all comers, man. Don't worry about Brexit.
It just feels like it's kind of like if you've got any kind of semblance of being British, like, they'll snap you up. Like,
yeah, of course,
you know what I mean?
But that's been happening. Have you seen the Qatari high jumper? He's obviously like from Africa somewhere. Like,
oh, the Qataris have been doing that for like days, haven't they? They've been doing it for like decades. Just like, you know.
Claiming all the lads.
Claiming.
It's a part of citizenship,
isn't it?
It's a part of the Olympics now, man.
It's like, part of all sports, isn't it? Yeah. You know, there's so many different sports now that you know, all you've had to do is live there for 5 years, and you are allowed to represent.
Sweet.
Yeah, we've won more Tough Golds.
Tough Golds.
Yeah, yeah, with our bourgeoisie British athletes winning in a team horse eventing. Some more like dressage.
Equestrian types.
Yeah, this was the one where they have to like jump over shit.
That's the most impressive. I've seen a horse buckle off the side of one of the fences before. It looked like it killed his leg.
Yeah, that's horrible. I wouldn't want to see that. But you know, I've got no resentment to these people. Like, it is a bit of a prestige sport, isn't it? But
yeah, you might as well do like fox hunting. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's like one of them things you'd never get
into. I imagine
that
probably was in the Olympics at one point, wasn't it? Fuck it, man. It's boosted the national morale, isn't it?
For the boys.
You know
what I mean?
Six golds in like a horse. I swear, we've just got poxy golds.
Poxy golds.
You know what I mean? We haven't got any good, strong.
Now, the swimming's good, man.
The swimming we smashed. Yeah, that was unexpected, but I think the cycling, we've won our first
one. And the triathlon as well. The four person, two women, two men. We got the gold in the triathlon for that. That's a sick one. Yeah,
there's a few good ones. And hopefully, Birmingham's own, get out of your fight.
He's the last man standing.
Gonna win the gold.
Of course he is, man.
Gonna win the dough for Tino.
Of course he is, man. It's happening.
So, we'll have a talk about him in a bit. We'll get some of the footy transfer news and the start of the championship season out of the way first. So, the big one on everyone's tongue in Birmingham is Jackie Grealish, Super Jack. Apparently, having his medical this morning in Manchester, so they say.
Well, it's been the news for a good few weeks now. £100 million move. Him and Harry Kane have been the main Man City targets, haven't they? I think if Kane goes to City, he's guaranteed starter. Nailed on. Do you think Jack Grealish plays week in, week out? Think about the players they've got there in that, in and around that area on the pitch. Bernardo Silva, Sterling, Riyad Mahrez, Phil Foden, even
Ferran Torres.
Oh yeah, forgot about him. Even
he was great in the Euros.
Even when Pep's feeling a bit fruity, he can get Gundogan out there.
Yeah.
He messes about in that kind of. Does Grealish play every week? I don't think he does.
Well, I seen a graphic yesterday. I think it was like the percentage. What percentage of game time players in his position had. And I don't think one of them had more than 75%. I think Sterling had 75%. He was highest. And then it was like Phil Foden had like something like 45%. It was like really low, man. Like in like all the minutes that they could have played.
The thing is, City gone for every trophy, didn't they? So you do need strength and depth.
Well, the thing is, he's going to go there, Grealish. He's going to be guaranteed a trophy. He's going to get minutes. Of course he is. Is he going to get as many minutes as he would be at Villa? No, because he'd be playing every week at Villa. But the fact is, and Matt Letizia was talking about this, and he was saying in like 1995, Chelsea offered him something like 10 grand a week. And it was easy to, he said he was a lot easier to turn down that. Like he cannot imagine turning down, say, 10 times that 100 grand. Because Grealish is going to be, he's going to be offered, I would say, in the upwards of, or the 100, so maybe 180 grand a week.
I reckon maybe more than that. Yeah.
So can you really turn this opportunity down? I don't blame him, man.
You've got a financial responsibility to yourself, man. When you're talking about that kind of money, and if you're clever and prudent with your finances, you can secure your kids' lives and their kids' lives. And that's a massive thing, man.
And it's glory as well. Yeah. You know what I mean? He wants to go and win stuff. Like what footballer wouldn't want to go and try and win the Champions League or win like the Premier League?
It's not like he hasn't put in the time with the Villa either. Do you know what I mean? He's been there for a good few years now. I think he debuted in like 2014 or something like
and
that.
And even when they got relegated, he still stayed with them and got them back into the Premier League.
He's done them a good time, yeah, man.
And now I would say Villa are in a really, really strong place in terms of their, you know, recruitment. Like they brought in Emi Buendia. Obviously they brought in that great keeper from Arsenal, which was, you know, they dropped a massive bollock by allowing him to
go.
But, you know, they brought in Emi Buendia. Obviously season before they brought in Ollie Watkins. There's talks about them bringing in, Leon Bailey. I think he's signed now, actually. They've signed Danny Ings recently, which is a great signing.
So,
they're putting together like a really strong side. And they're going to use that money wisely. I think that there's still another couple of signings that they could get in there.
I heard about Dele Alli a couple of weeks ago, maybe, man.
That'd be an awesome signing as well.
He's the one that impressed, you know.
I think Ward-Prowse as well, which I think would be a great signing for them.
They're looking, if they make all those transfers and put that 100 mil plus to good use, then they're on about like being Premier League mainstays. There's no danger going back down again in foreseeable. So
I'd be surprised if they don't manage to have at least another top 10 finish, possibly even pushing for Europa League football. So even without Grealish, man, because one player doesn't make a team. You can build a strong squad in the Premier League with good players that, right, not, maybe they're going to miss Grealish, but sometimes when you have your whole team, you know, sort of, you go through one player, do you know what I mean? So you're building your team around a player. Sometimes that can be at a disadvantage of other players that perhaps can't, you know, have the same sort of like,
input in the game,
flourish.
Influence.
Yeah. So influence is a big one. So you never know, man. It might work out well for Villa. So, obviously Harry Kane's gone missing. Yeah. He hasn't been training. So
he's definitely on the move, isn't
he? He's got to be on the move. So, you know, if obviously it's looking like really she's going to go to City, and you know, we don't know where Harry Kane's destination is, but there's, you know, there's a strong suggestion that it's going to be one of the Manchester clubs. If Man City sign Grealish and Harry Kane, should we just like fucking give the title to him?
What other team would you say is going to take the title off City this year? Okay, they had their one off year where Liverpool had to be absolutely unbelievable to beat them, and Liverpool fell off straight away. And then you start to understand just what goes into creating a consistent title winning
like
team.
Legacy. Yeah, like the same one that Alex Ferguson did, praise be.
The bastard, you got it in before me this week.
But what about Arsenal then? Look, because obviously they've signed Ben White, and this really, the comparison with this just like really struck me. So it's like they've signed Ben White, and Rafael Varane is supposedly going to sign with Manchester United, which seems to be taking a long time to go through. But see if we can work this out. So Rafael Varane, age 28 years old, 300 appearances for Real Madrid, played every minute during his World Cup win for France, 18 major honours, including 4 Champions League titles and 3 La Liga titles. along with a myriad of personal achievements. 42 million quid is the touted figure. Bargain. Ben White, on the other hand, has got an EFL Championship title to his name. Oh, and a Euro runners-up medal, which I'm sure, not even sure counts because he accumulated a total of 0 minutes for the team. So, like, guess how much? A reported £50 million. So not even the same price. 8 million more. Like, how, prior to the Euros, had you really heard of Ben White?
No, never.
So, you know, is he going to be that much of an improvement on, say, Rob Holding or, like, Callum Chambers, who is roughly around the same age, English, can play in the same position? I don't understand how Ben White is going to improve Arsenal.
Well, to be fair, the only thing I can think of in that regard is English players do command a premium. But also, like, Callum Chambers, he's like no one, is he? He's not that impressive of a player. When he came on the scene, everyone was raving about him. Yeah. What has he done? He ain't been that good for me. And you're buying potential with Ben White as well. With Varane, he's 28, getting into his prime years. How old is Ben White?
23, so 5 years younger.
Do you know what I mean? And then more than enough time to develop him into a world-class fullback. And then sell him to City, which is what they're always going to do. So
that's the dream, if that happens.
Yeah, like, but that's what will happen, man.
Look at Rob Holding. Obviously, they didn't spend the same amount of money. I think they signed it from Bolton. And I'm comparing them just because of their similarities, because of their age, because of like the fact they're English. So they're going to come through the same sort of like footballing philosophy. Like, I haven't really seen Ben White play much. Obviously, he's been at Brighton for a few years, hasn't he? Obviously, he was on loan at Leeds. But I just don't see. I don't see like how he can be, how they can command that sort of fee. For a centre-back?
50 million's nothing nowadays.
But for a centre-back that has not achieved anything, you know, and he's probably had, what, like a handful of good games in the Premier League? Maybe 20 good games in the Premier League.
Look, if a club's willing to pay 50 million and your agent's like just jacking the price up the whole time, that's how these things happen.
See, that's going to change. I think that's probably why, man. Like, that's going to change soon. Apparently, there's going to be restrictions on how much agents can make.
Yeah, good
luck. And I can't wait for that to fucking come in, man.
Yeah, good luck. Those all powerful agents are just going to give up their powerful status. They'll just find a little back door to walk through. But the Ben White thing might be an example of Arsenal making shite at the transfer market. But I was looking at their overall picture and see what you think it is. Granit Xhaka is set to stay after a stellar European championship.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So they're looking to get James Maddison in to replace Real Madrid banned Martin Odegaard.
So he's going back to Real Madrid. There has been no. I would have assumed that there was a sort
buyback
of
clause.
Yeah,
kind of.
Yeah.
I think that's my.
Because he was on loan, wasn't he? So I would have thought that there would have been a fee agreed. And I wouldn't have thought it would be that much. So obviously they don't like him that much. They're not all in.
Yeah, there. I mean, he was all right, but he weren't like no world beater. But obviously Real Madrid have seen something in him. So, and if they're willing to pay the fee, obviously Odegaard's going to want to go to Real Madrid as opposed to staying at Arsenal. Got no problem with that. But Arsenal already signed Nuno Tavares, the left back from Benfica. Midfielder Albert Lokonga from Anderlecht. I don't know who these players are.
Virtually unknown quantities, aren't they?
So like, do you say players like this, of this calibre, do you think they're able to elevate Arsenal past mid-table, or is it just more of the same?
Past mid-table, yeah, but like you should be looking at Arsenal competing. They need to compete.
But what,
far too long.
It's a tough sell to say to a world-class player, come to this team who's just finished 10th.
Yeah, but they've had the infrastructure for years, Arsenal, to be able to compete.
When was the last time they were legitimately challenging for a title? Was that 2008? Yeah, than 2008, 2009? Do you know what I mean? That is a tough sell for any world-class
player.
But
signing players like Ben White and, you know, James Maddison, right, are very good players.
That's a good addition, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a good addition, yeah? Yeah. But that's the sort of player that I wouldn't be surprised if Aston Villa signed. So that's the sort of level that we're looking at with Arsenal at the minute.
But Villa have been spanking Arsenal the last few seasons they've played each other. Like, so they're not that far apart. Even in the table finish, they're not that far apart.
Raheem Sterling was one of the best players in the Euros. And Man City were talking about offloading him.
Yeah, for 60 mil, which is crazy.
Ten mil more than Ben White. I would have rather invested that. If Arsenal signed Raheem Sterling, that would have been an unbelievable signing.
Yeah, yeah.
They still might.
He's not going to go anywhere now, man.
Anybody with any kind of recruitment like Guile would be looking at Man City and thinking, you've got a lot of an attacking midfielders. Like, what do you want for Raheem Sterling? What do you want for Ferran Torres? What do you want for Phil Foden?
Well, Arsenal obviously aren't that ambitious, are they? They're tight, man. They're famously tight. They're not going to pay anywhere near over the odds, which is why they've been slipping down the table for the past 15 years, man.
But I'm just really not sure that their recruitment strategy has been correct for
it's terrible
for so long.
Their recruitment and their when they decide to buy and sell players is an absolute mystery to me.
I mean, look, James Maddison, he wasn't fit in the sort of like latter end of the season, but he was still fit enough to go to the Euros. He wasn't even selected, man.
Yeah.
He wasn't even selected for that England team. So there's no way that Leicester could try, well, they will do, but I find it like deplorable that they try and commend like a huge fee for like James Maddison. You're probably looking at something similar, 50 million.
I don't know. It's a bit of a mystery to me, the transfer market, man, to be fair. Like, I don't, like we were saying about Slabhead, man, 80 million. He'd, imagine if he went somewhere else next season, like next summer window, he'd be like 150.
Or look at Liverpool. Apparently they want to still offload Shaqiri. That'd cost you, what, 12 million? Yeah. That's a bargain.
I'd have him.
He's 20, he's 29. He had a great Euros as well. Yeah. He looked fantastic. He scored about 3 goals.
Him and Xhaka got the link up.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And I've been saying this for about, I don't know how many years, when a, Arsenal are going to sign a player like Shaqiri. Like, they should have signed him when Liverpool signed him. I couldn't believe that they weren't in it for him, because I felt like he was the sort of player that would fit like the way Arsenal play really, really well. But I just can't see it, man. I can't see much improvement, if any.
Neither can I. But, you know, I can always save myself for that optimistic first 4 weeks when Arsenal string together 2 draws and a win and a loss. And I can think, oh, we're going to finish like 6th now or something.
Well, it's like terrible, you know, man. Moving on to the Championship and Birmingham as well. So, like, you know, they had a 4-0 loss against West Brom in a friendly, which it's not pretty. I think all the goals came in the second half. But, you know, there's been a bit of a... the Blues fans are sort of... worried, to say the least, how they're going to start the season. But they got Sheffield United away on Saturday. That's going to be a horrible game. We always we was going to get tickets, but through Tom Ali, asking me if we can use his season cards. But I was going to go with Tino, but he's got something on.
No go.
Mate, might change his mind if Galau wins that gold medal though, and he's got extra bunts in his pocket.
He'll go missing for a month, won't he? A couple of grand.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, so that Championship season, once again, it's a slog, isn't it, man? Anybody can go up.
Yeah, definitely, like, man. So many that is so unpredictable, man. Like, I wouldn't hazard a guess at any time during the season, because there's so many games, so many permutations, so many random bits of form in the Championship that we're talking about last season. It's like, there's literally no way to predict it.
And I think because of like the influence of the Premier League, what's happened is you've got players that should be playing in top leagues around Europe, and they kind of slip into like the Championship, innit? And like, obviously Fulham, I don't know if they've kept all of their players, but I think Sheffield United generally kept their squad, so they're going to have a strong team.
Yeah.
And Fulham always have a strong team because they're always financially backed. I can't even think of who their coach is now, because I think Parker went to Bournemouth, didn't he? So he's going to be a champion. I don't know why he's gone from Fulham to Bournemouth, because they're both going to be playing the Championship, I think, aren't they?
So Bournemouth are relegated anyway, so he's gone from one Championship team to another.
So he's gone from one Championship team to another. I don't know why he managed to do that, because I think he was probably looking if he could keep Fulham up, because they were playing a really nice brand of football. I think they were really unlucky for Fulham to get relegated last season. They had a lot of draws where they dominated games and they didn't quite get the 3 points, but I think the brand of football they were playing was wicked, man. So I was thinking that he, you know, potentially was going to get like a decent job in the Premier League and then perhaps push for when Southgate wants to step aside and perhaps have another go at club management, then there might be sort of like, you know, an opportunity for him. But yeah,
there's a lot going on.
All right, so we'll move on to the combat sports stuff.
Our main man before the tournament, Pat McCormack, takes silver, which is no mean feat, but he lost to Cuba's Ronel Iglesias in the welterweight final. Historically, the Americans are the most successful Olympic boxing nation, but it's the Cubans who have the second highest medal tally, incidentally followed by GB, who are third in the all-time list.
Yeah, I think we've been successful over the last sort of 3 Olympic cycles, and especially with the heavyweights.
Yeah, definitely. But I think there was a period in the 80s where the Americans and the Soviet countries, which included Cuba at the time, they like boycotted one event after another. So that's probably skewed the medal list in the boxing.
Where have the American boxers been this time, man?
The last Olympic gold medalist from the US was Andre Ward in 2004.
Christ.
Yeah, so they've really fell off there. 1976 teams and 1984 teams are legendary. Like, just plastered through with gold medalists and world champions. Like, unattainable levels of success.
I feel like there's a bit of the culture and the sort of like the processes that the American, not just the boxers, but what I notice is with the baseball, obviously that's the first time that baseball and softball have been included in the Olympics. But the Americans didn't even send out a team. Well, they sent out a team, but not like the professionals from the MLB. Whereas the Japanese and the South Koreans, they completely stop their season to send their best players over. I wonder if there's a bit of an issue with trying to like galvanize players, you know, boxers, especially from America, to rather than being an amateur, staying an amateur and going, you know, work, say, do an eight year cycle to work towards getting Olympic gold. It's a lot more commercially viable to them just go straight and be a pro.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's an issue with that, because we spoke about the sort of like conflict between the amateur and professional, and then there being sports that allow professionals like golf and the basketball.
As well.
Yeah, because they got the Americans got like, I think, Kevin Durant's there and Andre Iguodala, and you know they got some big names. Like
it's tough for the Americans. I feel like they fell off on everything. Like that Michael Johnson was saying about the relay today. It's like he said it was an embarrassing show out for them in the like passing the batons. Like, look at the talent we've got. He's like, we haven't medaled in the Olympics in however many years. He's like, this is embarrassing. He's like, they're not practicing this, obviously. So what does that tell you about the mindset of the athletes?
And especially considering like how much of a sporting nation the US is. Like they are sport mad. Like literally everything, almost everything in their economy revolves around sport. So I don't know whether it always comes back to like, is there funding in the right areas? Like, do you think that maybe they've peeled back on funding in terms of the boxing for the US athletes?
The Cubans have no funding at all. And look at what this is. It's a philosophy thing and a training thing. Like, I don't imagine the Jamaican Olympic setup is that awash with money, but they've got the recipe for success. And this is what you see with the Cubans, man. Like,
but they can't go pro, can they?
Yeah, exactly. That's another factor. The main difference you see between the English boxers.
Well, they can't realistically make money, can they?
Yeah,
because of the social and political structure that they have in Cuba. I'm not privy to that much of the information from it, but I'd imagine there's kind of like a dictatorship in it.
Yeah, kind of. It's changing now.
Not as bad as the Castro days, but like, I imagine it's still a bit like.
But like Luke McCormack, Pat McCormack's brother, he consoled himself after his defeat, saying, look, I'm going to turn pro now. He's like, I want the big bucks. He said, that lad that's just beat me, he's going to be amateur for the rest of his life. And it was a snidey little jab he had at him after the fight. But it tells you, like, how these Cubans are so good, because that's all they're training. A lot of them, that's all they're training for is a 3-round distance.
Yeah.
And you can see the difference between Pat McCormack and this run out Iglesias, where like the philosophical approach to the 3-round format, Iglesias slipping into these almost invisible pockets of space and firing off blinding counters in close. You knock McCormack down in the second round with a crisp left hand. Somehow that wasn't called, not for the first time in this Olympics. It's so puzzling what they call a knockdown and what they give a standing count for. He still wheeled away with the unanimous decision victory. McCormack, fair play to him. He didn't seem overawed by the occasion, just overmatched by the season campaigner. And there's no shame in that, do you know what I mean?
So
Dan Iglesias was unbelievable. So you can't say nothing about it. Sometimes you just meet world-class talent. Are you going to win the gold medal match, ain't you, really? But like, same with Galal Yafai. He's through to the flyweight semifinals with a decision where he's the only guy to beat a Cuban. Yasvany Vitia. Vishia?
The only time anyone's ever beat a Cuban?
No, in this tournament. So
in this
tournament, Cubans have been dusting us off, except for Galal Yafai. So I can only speak for the third round because BBC's coverage has been absolutely dire. But Yafai did a great job cutting the space down, crowding the Cuban. That still could have gone either way.
I think it's the first round. The first round was a real determining factor in that fight. And we spoke about that because of the format of it only being 3 rounds. And like, if you get out quick and have a good first round, and I think he won it. I think he won it 5-0 in that first round.
Nice little cushion that is.
So it's huge. Yeah. It's huge. And then the Kazakhstani, he didn't really have a chance to dominate.
This is
against Cuba.
This is against that Yasvany Vitea, what do you call him? So this qualified him. This guaranteed him a medal for bronze.
Now bronze.
At 7 o'clock this morning, he advanced to the gold medal match by beating the Kazakh fighter, or what was it?
He had a bout against the Spanish guy, and it looked a bit messy, man. Like I watched their bout, and I think Yafai's got a chance against either of these.
Yeah.
And if you watch it through, it's all about that intensity. And
he's a really good pressure fighter, Yafai, which is not something I'd associate with the amateur game. He gets on people's chests. He fires the left hand. He looks for uppercuts and he looks for right hooks. And he keeps a tight guard. He does get clipped quite a lot for someone who's in the amateurs. You'd think there'd be more emphasis on defence. But what he's got is working for. He's 28 now. He's had a long time in the amateur ranks. 6 yard amateur bouts. He's a Commonwealth champion. He's seasoned there. If he's going to win gold, he's going to win it now. Do you know what I mean?
And I think either way, he's given himself a good platform to move into the pro game now, isn't he, from this, surely? Well,
kind of. I mean, we spoke last week. I mean, is there much of an upside for him to go pro? As a gold medalist, Paris is only in 3 years, man. He's 31. He could nab another, like, I think it's a more...
But from a financial perspective, in terms of, like, setting himself up,
As a flyer.
Can he really be earning that much money from being an Olympic gold? You know, being part of the Olympic boxing setup, you know, could he earn a lot more money by, you know, getting picked up by
I think it's probably a more secure income. Because as a flyweight, like, his brother was, I hate to say this, but promoted masterfully by Eddie Hearn into, like, big paydays for flyweight world titles. So there is a viable route there. Same with Charlie Edwards and Sonny Edwards. Like, there is success, but it's not the most lucrative division. And you could get
Luke Campbell, who won gold. Did he win gold?
Lightweight, he did. Yeah. I think. But like, so it's I don't know, man. I think I'm on the fence as to what he's going to do. He might just think, forget it. I'm just going to go 5 years as a pro, see if I can win a world title, which is a viable route as well. But big up to Galal Yafai, the last man standing, man. As we're going to see, so Ben Whitaker boxed on the outside in his light heavyweight match to outmaneuver the Russian Imam Katayev, and this was before his. This was before the gold medal match where he lost a split decision to another Cuban, Arian Lopez, in the final. So you struggle to hit that Lopez with a handful of rice, to be honest with you.
I think the thing is, like, I was talking to you about how he was the least amateurish boxer that I've seen so far, like, in the whole Olympics. Like, he just looked pro, man. Yeah. Like, just everything about his technique looked so much cleaner than everyone else at four.
He's got great movement. He's got a long jab. He uses his height to his advantage, which is so many tall fighters don't do. It's such a refreshing thing to see, such a young fighter doing that. He manages to duck, change direction really quick. He manages to get under hooks, and usually he's the taller opponent. So that shows you his mobility, his dexterity, his anticipation. He's got all the tools, man. I can see him out of all the fighters on the GB squad this year that I've seen. I think he's got the best chance, considering his age and his style and his temperament. So, and now the Olympic silver medal to his name, a lot of commercial appeal there as well. Good looking kid. He's not shy on the microphone. He's got all the
How old is he?
23, I think.
Okay, so he's got time on his side, isn't
he? Yeah, he's got everything going for him. And I saw he did what the English players did in the Euros, and he wouldn't wear his silver medal because he was so disappointed not to get gold. I mean, a silver medal is a massive lifetime achievement, man.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, again, sour grapes, but I do understand it.
Yeah, there was a bit of a debate coming out about, you know, bronze and silvers, and should you respect them, and should you sort of like celebrate them like they're a gold. But at the end of the day, I think you go to Olympics and something you train for 4 years, and you manage to come in that top three. Like, you should be proud of it, man.
You've got every right to celebrate.
But on the other side to that, he's got every right to feel disappointed, of course. Because if he's gone there with the intention of winning gold, and he sort of replayed that visual in his mind every night going to bed. What,
that was a close fight as well. Yeah. That must be the most gutting thing. Like, for Pat McCormack, he was pretty, like, handily outclassed.
Yeah.
But for Ben Whitaker, that's a split decision. That I'm not saying he should have won it, but...
Was that a strategy issue, though? Because it seems to me... that in these 3 round bouts, like in the Olympics, and the way they scored and what the judges are looking for and the way the referee's being conducted, is the best way to go out and win a fight is do what Yafai did. Go out there in that first round.
Just put it on them.
Like, go for quantity, almost quantity, not quality, but like just the pure volume of the punches thrown.
Yeah, there's a lot of
And to the referees, they're probably thinking, right, this guy's up for it, innit? Yeah. And then if you can, which is what Yafai did this morning, if you can sustain it, he didn't sustain it throughout all the 3 rounds. He dropped off a little bit in the second, but then he just did enough in the third to make sure that his opponent, there wasn't a clear victor.
And that's that pacing that you talk about, that you become in tune with the 3 round limit, which is what the Cubans are so good at, man. It's like when Ben Whitaker, in the final round, he knew he couldn't just put it on that Lopez because that is just like, the Cubans will eat that up all day. If you start throwing loads of punches at them, they're slipping and sliding, bang, they hit you with a right hand, and then you're around your heels and you're getting an 8 count. Do you know what I mean? They're perfect.
He fought on the outside a lot more than, say, someone like Yafai would, because he loves fighting on the inside. So I think there's a big difference.
He fought like he he suspected he was going to win.
Yeah.
So that just shows it. Maybe he was judging the contest differently in his mind than the judges were seeing. And that's, you know, that's just part of boxing.
And that's probably what sets, you know, like you were saying, that Whitaker's probably the most ready-made to go into the pro game. Only being 23 as well. Like, you could see him boxing 8 rounds like that.
Picking
people off.
And he would as well. Like,
yeah.
All day, he'd be picking long jab. Just get past his jab and try and pin him down. Good luck.
So it'd be interesting to see where they go from here. All right, so I think the last one that we really need to speak about, obviously, Caroline Dubois got beat. She got beat by...
On the list somewhere. But she went out, but she was lucky to go through against the American. So bear in mind again, we'll say, like, she's 20, first Olympics. She's got loads of time to come back. Yeah. She'll be 23 by the time Paris comes around.
Oh, look at that. She's going to have more of a chance there, isn't she?
Yeah, so Luke McCormack's already gone out. Caris Artinstall, she got knocked out as well. And the last one, as you say, Fraser Clark. He went to the super heavyweight semi-final with a DQ win over the Frenchman after the referee had judged him to use his head too much in the clinch. To me, it didn't look like he was being overt with his head. But then two gashes opened up over Fraser Clark's eyes, and you think he must have been doing something in there.
Because they weren't from punches, were they?
Yeah, and it came back to bite Clark in the end, because he made it through against the world number one, the Uzbek Bakadir Jalilov, the southpaw. And the cut opened up. I mean, I think Fraser Clark gave him a standing count in the second. As we know, that doesn't impact the scoring as much as it would in the pros.
Yeah, it's not like a 10-8. It's not an automatic 10-8, is it?
But the Uzbek, he just saw what was going on and just carried on firing that left hand. The doctor got called over once, he let it go. Start of the third round, got called over again, they stopped it. To me, I didn't think the cut was impeding his vision. If you're going to have a horrible cut, if it's going to be on the outside arch of your eye, it's going to trickle down on the outside. Whereas if it's in your eyebrow or on your eyelid...
That's a problem.
That is a massive problem. So, yeah, I know it's a bit more sterile in the amateurs, but I think he was hard done by them. But then again, he didn't have no sour grapes afterwards. He said, this is a massive achievement for me. I said, I'm really proud of my bronze medal. I'm really proud of all my teammates. He just showed, like, class in a massively disappointing moment.
Yeah, it's disappointing for him because obviously he's 28. He's been sort of superseded first by Anthony Joshua in 2012, then Joe Joyce in 2016. So he's like, I feel for him because he's been on the circuit for such a long time. He's, you know, 10 years, really 10 years in the making. But I thought he took it really, really well, man.
And it turns out, like, he's well chosen as a team captain, because to have that presence, they almost want to just cry their eyes out. But as you say, we spoke about this over this episode as well. It's like that you don't have to give all of yourself to, like, it's a more of a humble thing, more of like a restrained thing. And maybe it's like asking a bit much of him. I don't know. But is there any other ones? Oh, Lauren Price.
Yeah, did she? I didn't see what happened with her.
The middleweight world number one, she hasn't got knocked out yet. This is the thing with the scheduling as well. Like,
so she hasn't fought yet?
I don't think so.
All right.
Galau Yafai, he had how many days between his bouts? And then Clark got cut, and then he fought like 2 days later.
Yeah, it's mad.
So I don't know what the scheduling situation is.
Is that there. Lauren Price? Seems to have fought like about a week ago? I can't remember the last time she fought.
Missions. She might have got a bye as well, though. Just to give a little big up to Japan and their fighter, Senna Irie, who knocked out Caris Artinstall. She won 3-2. Caris had a number of close fights throughout the brackets, and she was on the losing end here. But I think big up Japan, because they even got form in this event. I can't really think of a time where a Japanese fighter is impressed in the amateur ranks. So fair play to him, man. And we'll move on to the pro boxing from last weekend. And obviously, Conor Benn, he got the COVID. So he was superseded in the main event spot by Lee Wood, who won his first world title at featherweight against China's Kan Shu with a 12th round knockout. He absolutely boxed him up, man. I thought Kan Shu was...
He was a favourite as well, wasn't he? Chinese fighter.
I watched a bit of footage on Zhu, and I thought, oh, he looks massive for the weight. You know what, next to Lee Wood, he looked undersized. And he looked a little bit weight-drained as well, man. He had kind of the empty flesh around the stomach and the flatness in the pecs that you see from a fighter who's really struggled to make the weight. So I don't know if that was an issue for him, but the variety from Wood, the power from Wood, like the uppercuts working a treat, jab to the head and butt, everything was stiff. His right hooks to the body, you could hear him. There was a palpable smack, and you don't often hear that. So Wood was too strong for him, too much variety. And as the fight was building, too much confidence. Like he was in a flow state. You could just see he was picking, he was like he was sparring. And that is absolutely ideal.
Dangerous as well, yeah. For any opponent.
Yeah, broke him down. And I'm not sure if he gave Zhu a count before the stoppage, but they stopped it with 10 seconds to go. And Zhu didn't argue at all. So he took a bit of a hammering in there, man. So
what was it, the ninth round? He got knocked out?
Nah, 12.
Or was it
10 seconds to go?
Pretty much went the distance, like.
Yeah. And on the undercard there, Tommy McCarthy from Belfast lost his European cruiserweight crown to Chris Billum-Smith, who added it to his Commonwealth strap, and he nabbed the British in there as well. So he's like a unified domestic level champion there. A deserved 12-round decision for Billum-Smith. He's 13-1 there. And now he's in the picture for Cruiserweight World Honour. So the big slime, Eddie Hearn, needs to sort him out because he's got Lawrence Okolie with the WBO title at Cruiserweight. Easy to make. But I think, in all fairness, I think Okolie will absolutely smash Billum-Smith. But that's the fight to make now. You're European, British and Commonwealth. There's nowhere else to go. He might have a knockover or two. I heard him maybe talking about the rematch. But if I was Billum-Smith, I wouldn't be taking that, man. Why would you have another dangerous domestic level fight where you can get the bag against Okolie, man? Why would you?
So this was one of them, because I noticed where it was. It was somewhere in Essex or something.
It's in Eddie Hearn's back garden.
No way. Is that actually where it was?
Fight camp. That's Matchroom headquarters. Like, that's in the garden.
Yeah, because obviously, Laura Woods and Maya Jama, I think they were knocking about, weren't they, on the commentary team.
You know, I didn't even watch the full DAZN coverage, man. I just watched the main event. So I avoided all that awkward commentating that I've heard about since. So apparently Maya Jama didn't have a clue. Like,
yeah. Bless her. Yeah, yeah. I suppose probably not, because it's I imagine it's her first time commentating on boxing.
Yeah, so I can be.
She's having to adjust, yeah. But you know.
Also on the undercard, yeah. Anthony Fowler, he looked good in stopping his late replacement opponent, Rico Mueller from Germany. He stopped him in the 8th round, and he's now earned himself an all-scouse super fight against former world champion.
I was going to say, he's a scouse,
yeah, man. So this is a big one for Liverpool. And if Fowler manages to win against Smith, he'll prove himself to be at top level, because Smith is a former world champion and he's consistently fought at a high level. Jaime Munguia, that Russian lad he lost a split decision to a couple of months ago. And, you know, he's never been slaughtered by anyone except for Canelo. And who doesn't get slaughtered by Canelo?
Yeah, true.
So if Fowler can put together a game plan here, working with Shane McGuigan, I think he's coach now. You know, that's a massive, massive step up. Promotable.
So it's going off in these weight divisions in with the British boxing at the moment, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's sick, man. Absolutely sick. And this weekend as well, another one for the lads. Like, we got featherweights, Michael Conlon and Jazza Dickens and TJ Dahini and Kid Galahad all fighting each other. So Conlon versus Dahini for the WBA interim on Friday. Jazza Dickens, Kid Galahad for the vacant IBF. That's the one that Josh Warrington vacated before he got knocked out by what's his name. Mauricio Lara. Yeah. That's it. So Lee Wood, he's just got his regular WBA title. Depending on who wins here, they could either say, I'm assuming Conlon's going to beat TJ Dahini, then there's a potential unification match there. Whoever wins out of Jazza Dickens and Galahad, I'm assuming it's going to be Galahad. There's a potential unification there, which is big paydays for the featherweight boys. It's going off, man. It's absolutely sick.
Yeah,
I can't wait for it, man. And that Kid Galahad Jazza Dickens one, I think it's going to be a good fight, man. It's a rematch from about 10 years ago.
So we've had a couple of quiet weeks internationally. What's the next sort of the big international fight?
Big international fight?
Because we were obviously, I think we meant to have Josh. Was that Joshua meant to be this month? I think it was meant to be August, wasn't it?
Anti-Joshua?
Yeah, the Joshua Fury fight was meant to be August, wasn't it?
Oh, let's not, that forgotten ghost of a fight, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's all been a bit fucking mixed up, ain't it? Or COVID just seems to keep on killing the boxing, man.
Yeah, or used as an excuse by certain heavyweight champions to get a few more weeks under the belt for camp. But for the MMA, Uriah Hall versus Sean Strickland from last weekend's Fight Night card. Wicked fight, man. I mean, yeah, like, yeah. These two aren't going to be challenging Adesanya anytime soon, but like, Sean Strickland just drowned Uriah Hall with volume and like leg kicks, mixing in his takedowns, and Uriah Hall did well to stay at a distance.
Obviously, the more experience than the Uriah Hall, but this Strickland guy, he seems like a nut. And you see what he said after, like, he was like, I'd probably be like cooking meth if it weren't fair.
Yeah, he looks like that kind of guy.
Yeah, he looks like that sort of guy.
He looks like an extra from Breaking Bad or something. Like,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. So, like, I don't know, fair fox in there.
But I watched one of the undercard fights as well. Brian Barberina versus Jason Witt. They beat the living shit out of each other. Oh, that's probably the best fight of the card, man. Watch it. Yeah. It's on YouTube now. Check it out. Well worth it. I think Jason Witt pulled out the split decision win because he mixed in his wrestling a bit better. But
was it quickly talk about Cheyenne Beast? Is Cheyenne Beast, is that how you pronounce her second name?
Cheyenne Beast.
B-U-Y-S, and she was, I think she got Fight of the Night or something.
I didn't even see it. No.
She got like the 50k payday, and we watched her video, and she was saying about how much that means for her.
Yeah, because she gets 10 to show and 10 to win, and then she got Fight of the Night. So she was saying like, I've been so broke for years over this sport.
Mad.
It's like, I just want to, my husband's going to tell me to put this away, but I want to like get some things for the house and treat my team to a meal.
Yeah, it's, I was like, that's wicked, man. And like, I think the commentator came out, and I suppose it's kind of like with these arbitrary questions, like, oh, how much, you know, how much is that 50 min? She was like, Well, I'm in negative balance mentality now.
Don't ask me that fucking question.
Yeah, she was like, I'm negative. She was like, you know, this sport, like, you know, it's killed me financially, like, since...
But she loves it, like, like, increasingly now, the UFC are coming under criticism for the way they pay their fighters.
Yeah, because I did briefly look at the Bellator card, and apparently they paid their geezer, like, $1 million for his win. Sick. I can't remember his name, but, like, he was fighting in like, a championship bout against
the
geezer.
You know, the Bellator. Yeah. I fell off covering them because, like, by the time we get through the boxing and through the UFC,
But $1 million they gave their geezer for their championship.
Yeah,
win.
Sweet.
And then Dana White's coming under criticism because, like, he's got some of his athletes that are, like, you know, high up on the card, like quite high up on the card, and like struggling to fucking make ends meet, man.
Well, this feeds into the this week's UFC. Is it 265? Yeah, the headline is Cyril Gane. I thought he was said Gagne, but everyone's saying Gane now. So I'm going to switch that up. So, Cyril Gane against Derek Lewis. The accents.
The accent is in it, yeah.
So, them two are going to be fighting for the interim heavyweight title. Francis Ngannou is uninjured. And for all intents and purposes, a dispute between Ngannou's agent, who's the current heavyweight champion, an issue between his agent and Dana White, has basically brought about this interim title fight. It's a big fuck you to Francis Ngannou. And he's been posting, talking about Jake Paul and how much his opponents have been making. And Jake Paul himself has been making a Logan Paul against Mayweather. And he's like saying, how are we not getting...
So he's getting... Yeah, he's like, it's like... With Tyron Woodley, I don't know how much they're going to make from that.
But this is the thing as well. Like, I don't think... It's a similar thing to Megan Rapinoe and the US women's team. It's like, if you don't generate...
It's a dispute about payment.
Yeah, if you don't generate this amount of money, you're not going to get paid this amount of money. Do you know what I mean? So Ngannou and the lads, they're not generating Jake Paul numbers. Jake Paul, like, you know, kind of money.
Yeah, of course, it's because obviously he's got an audience stream that goes far beyond the UFC, isn't it? Because obviously the people that watch MMA generally they're sports fans that are very specifically into mixed martial arts. Whereas, like, this geezer, Jake Paul, Logan Paul, they're pulling in sources from, like, their global franchise that they've built over in the YouTube and, like, the social media world. Do you know what I mean? And we spoke about how much they engage with their content and their heroes, essentially, you know, in the social media world. So he's bringing, like, a completely different market to the table.
It's so unrealistic for a fighter like Francis Ngannou. If I said to... If I meet 10 people in the street right now...
Who's Francis Ngannou?
Who's Francis Ngannou? Yeah. No one's going to know. So... I bet you one or two of them will know who Jake Paul is, though. Or Logan Paul. I bet you they would.
I'd push that up to, like, maybe even, like, three or four, innit?
So there
the
you
general
go.
People.
So for Ngannou...
Especially our age, innit?
Yeah. So for Ngannou and fighters like Paulo Costa to be like, oh, I want $500,000. It's like, mate, the UFC has a very definite purse structure. Like, even the champions don't get paid that much compared to boxing. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So it's a little bit like...
I mean, obviously, you got Stipe Miocic down there as well. Like, you know, 38 years old. Is he really... he's not really, you know, a commercial sort of, like...
They've been slacked to Miocic.
Yeah.
Proper slacked to him, man.
He's like, only lost, what, three or four fights, and he? Like, did he beat Ngannou once and then lost to Ngannou.
Yeah, so he's waiting for his trilogy match, and they're like, nah, I'm not going to give that to you.
We're just going to put on this Garnet versus Derek Lewis.
It should be a sick fight. If there wasn't all this, like, cloudiness around it, like, all this smoke, it's like, I'd enjoy it a bit more. But, like, it's a nice little clash of styles. Derek Lewis, he's just, like, some absolute street fighter.
Yeah, he's a big boy, isn't he?
Gets his right hand away and he cleans clocks for jokes, man. Like, we've seen what he did to Curtis Blaydes in his last fight. Just slept him with one uppercut. Seen what he did to Alexander Volkov, who's a common opponent of him and Cyril Gane. Beat him with 10 seconds to go after getting his head kicked in for like 25 minutes.
Obviously, Gane's undefeated. Though. He's come over to UFC a little. Has he had like five fights? And
I think he's 9-0.
No, so he's a bit of an unknown quantity on this story. Who's he beat?
Volkov. You know, he's beat Volkov, he's beat Rozenstruik, and he's beat a former champion, Junior Dos Santos. He's got form, man. Do you know what I mean?
He's got pedigree.
Apparently, he only started training like 3 years ago. And the way he moves, he's got switch hits, he's up on his toes, the geezer weighs 245 pounds, man. He's like, I don't know how he's able to move.
He's
like that.
One of, like, I remember watching him, I think it was against Rozenstruik, or maybe his last time out. But I was just in awe about how agile he was, you know what I mean?
Like, the way he mixes in his elbows and his knees and his feints. Dan Hardy did a breakdown of, like, how he throws a right hand or feints to throw a right hand just to switch his stance. And then, like, throws an elbow or a knee afterwards. And it's such a deliberate, like, setting traps. Like, you don't really see heavyweights doing that, man.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
sick. But the card overall is sick. Like, Jose Aldo and Pedro Munoz, and then Michael Chiesa versus Vicente Luque. That rounds off the main card. Like, the UFC always brings the heat for these events. This is going to be sick, man. All Sunday, I'm going to be watching us.
And let's just hope that there isn't any more like late cancellations of co-main events, because that even this weekend, it turned into a not a dead rubber, but just from last weekend, the UFC. I think there was two co-main events that were cancelled because of like either COVID, or I think one was for an injury, one was through COVID. Let's just keep a fucking full card on, man.
It's tough for them to stay healthy, don't it? And some of them miss weight, and like there's so many different bits of training you have to do. So much potential for injury, man. Mm. Like it's tough. I find it amazing. Anyone makes it tough, and then they do the weight cut as well. So. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and how on earth they do that? Or within days, like...
Rough. Absolutely rough. But yeah, that's the roundup. That's the previews and reviews of everything, man.
Yeah, all right, wicked. All right, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week. I'll see you again next week, son.
Next week, kid.